Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, where you will hear, I don't know if you guys heard that random noise that came into my headphones or not, but that was sort of interesting.
Yeah, it was this sound that my computer usually makes when I change a volume, but my computer's not plugged in. It's kind of a standard sound, so it may be one of the multiple computers plugged in a very strange fashion made a noise.
Yeah. That was the sound of chaos.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There it goes again.
There's another one. That's some kind of alert coming from someplace. I don't know. Maybe they can. Maybe they can't hear it out there.
Got it.
What was it?
One of the engineers' Facebook Messenger was talking to him through one of the computers over here. I now have that.
Oh, cool. Off. So that was Facebook.
Yeah, we got Facebook communication with one of the engineers.
And we do have a caller on 773-1400 before we've even done our disclosure. So
let's do the disclosure really quick. Caller, okay. We'll be with you in just a moment.
The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado. Not that the SEC approves or disapproves of anything we're doing, but they are a regulatory authority.
Though they're getting unpaid time off or possibly paid time off at the moment.
Paid time off?
Well, they're not. Nobody knows if it's paid time off or not because they're not at work.
Well, there are unpaid supervisors, regulators.
Regulators.
Yeah, that's it. And let's see, the information we provide on this program is informational and educational. It is not considered to be investment advice, and you should not invest or de-invest or disinvest or whatever it is you do. Based on the information here, you should consult with a appropriate investment advisory firm before
some
you make a decision.
Fiduciary, although if you're investing on your own, you could probably get some good education out of this program.
Well, there's a good fiduciary that you can see in the mirror.
Yeah. They will work in your best interest.
Absolutely. The person you see in the mirror will tend to work in your best interest at all times.
Well, not always. Sometimes they make decisions that are a little weird.
May be weird, but they believe.
I've had that conversation with the guy in the mirror before.
Their intent is to work in your best interest.
Yes.
I'm completely bamboozled.
We've finished
the
disclosure. Yeah, well, our opinions are not those of Town Square Media. There you go.
We don't even know what opinion Town Square Media has.
I don't even know if they have opinions.
I've never even found the Town Square.
Yeah, all right.
But we have a caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, presuming that today is the 29th of December, 2018.
Yes.
And caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sir.
Good morning.
You know, I always try to call early to get the silly questions out of the way, and any questions I ask y'all from any perspective, y'all make it educational for me to understand. And the question I have for y'all is for electronics. I have a friend that works on televisions, and I went to go visit him, and he showed me he had a little bottle with gold in it. And I said, where do you get that? He said, I get it from all these components off of these televisions.
Mm-hmm.
See all these televisions here, that's where I get them from. And the reason for my call is I didn't realize that they use gold for components. And I'm just curious to find out, is that why some of these components are very expensive due to the fact of the kind of material they use? You have a good day and thank you, sir.
Thank you, and you have a happy new year.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yes, gold is used in electronics quite often. It's a noble metal, which means it doesn't corrode. That's extremely helpful when you're
good. It gets the Nobel Prize.
Yes, it gets the Nobel Prize. You got me messed up there. See what you did? A noble metal doesn't lose its electrons. So it is really good at keeping them inside its own metal. So a copper can lose its electron to other elements and other groups of atoms and molecules. You can lose these. So over time, a copper wire that you're using, if anybody that has ever remodeled an old house, if it's an older set of copper wire, the copper is a lot more brittle because electricity has been moving those electrons through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it causes there to be some heat buildup and you get some decay.
Steals some.
Yeah, and oxygen grabs them, and so you have this slow decay of the metal when you run electricity through it, except if it's gold. Gold does get more brittle, but it retains the same electrical charge it had before.
Its conductivity remains consistent.
Yeah, and you can make it flexible again by banging it down again. By heating it up a little bit. Give it a little massage. It gets flexible again.
It's kind of like us old folks. We get a little massage and we get flexible again.
Right. And before you get too excited about gold in electronics, there have been repeated attempts to make a profit out of recycling the gold in electronics. And the reality is that the refining, so if you can, it's not fine, it's refined, but then you got to do it again, re-refine it. You got to get the gold out of the other pieces. If you think about how you would do that, you could possibly, if you had extremely fine motor skills, use a scalpel and scrape the gold off the wire off. Well, I thought I had that fixed. It is not fixed. I don't know. So you could scrape it slowly off of the electronic component. That is not time effective. You would not make any. I mean, the amount of money you would make an hour is measured in pennies. If you use nitric acid, and dissolve the gold, you get some other stuff in there, as well. You're running about a $3 an hour if you have gathered for years, about $3 an hour when you're doing it in bulk. Is it profitable in scale, big scale? Barely. If you're already recycling the other stuff, it's more profitable.
Actually, in China, they pretty much stopped it in China. It's going on in India now.
Right. It causes a lot of pollution as well.
There was a serious attempt to recycle the gold and other materials out of overused electronics, and they gradually came to the conclusion, if you don't mind killing off all the people who are doing it because they're poisoned by the lead that's in there.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't mind totally polluting all the water supply in your area.
Yeah, there are uses of some pretty deadly toxins.
And you can make about $3 a day off of several tons.
Right. And so it happens at scale in certain places, but it's not very profitable. If you're doing it for fun, there's a couple of YouTube channels you can check out on that. One is called Cody's Lab, where he refines the process. He shows you the whole way to do it, using all multiple different methods to get there, and he makes it kind of fun. It's not like a science-y program. He messes up in his diction and his English, but he's got a pretty good knowledge base. He's in college at the moment. So go to Cody's Lab and check that out. It's not profitable.
That makes it a nonprofit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's move on. The personal wealth coach is who we are, and we report on things like what happened in the market during the last week. This was an amazing week. Records broken all over the place. It was just
You're going to get kicked out of the record store. No more vinyl for you. You're breaking the records. Stop it.
We don't normally talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average, but it made the headlines, so we got to talk about it. It rose 1,086 points on Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas, which is not only the most it's ever risen in a single day. When I first started in this business, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was breaking through 1,000, so it would have had to come from 0 to 1,000 to get 1,000 points, and it did it in a single day on Boxing Day. Of course, it dropped the next day 611 points. But by the end of the day, it turned it into a 260-point gain on Thursday, which was the greatest swing up and down, both in the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And the S&P 500 goes back to 1871. It wasn't called the S&P 500 at the time, but they track the index that became the S&P 500 stock index can be tracked all the way back to 1871. And as a percentage, certainly in numbers, because they're inflated, but as a percentage, that was the greatest market volatility in a single day in the history of the S&P 500. So we broke another record.
1,000 point up
in the Dow.
That's another record.
And then,
not as a percentage, but as a...
Right. It was just... And another one, presuming that we don't get a massive rally in the market on Monday, and I in the newsletter put 1929, but actually it was 1931. This will be the worst December since 1931. It was the worst New Year's Eve, not New Year's Eve, but it was the worst Christmas Eve in the history of any of the market indices. And we're set up in the major indices for the worst December since 1931. Does that mean that we're in a bear market? No. Matter of fact, the S&P 500, which is generally the gold standard, that's a nice term, dropped intraday to down 19.3%. In other words, if you take the peak that it hit in the middle of a day, back in September,
and the trough that it hit in the middle of the day,
then you had a drop of 19.3%. Then that was what apparently triggered the 1,000-point rise in the Dow and the equal percentage rise.
So the drop triggered the rise?
Yes.
Because a lot of people jumped in?
But exactly. People looked at the price of stocks and said, this is absurd. These companies are worth a lot more under the worst-case scenario than they're currently selling for. And there's a reason that all this happened. Now, but the bottom line for the week, we report on the week, is the Dow was up 2.7%, the S&P 500 was up 2.9%, and the NASDAQ was up 4% for the week. So if you just didn't pay any attention to what the markets are doing during the week, you'd say, man, this was a good week.
Yeah, sure looks nice. I wish we could have a week like that every week.
Well, yeah.
Maybe not.
But there's a really good reason that the indices did this amazing flip-flop, roller coaster ride, dive, surge upward. It's a little complex, but it's very real, and we go through these periods every once in a while of extremely high short-term volatility. The first one I remember was 1987, and we didn't know what to do with it. The system was completely overloaded, and it was we couldn't buy. The sell side completely swamped the system.
Right.
And we have a caller on 254-773-1400, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show, guys. I know these big point swings and records make good headlines, but if you're a long-term investor, why do we really care about that stuff? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
That is probably the best question that could be asked ever.
But there is
when
a reason,
it comes to the market.
There is a reason to care, but it's probably best to ignore it.
Yeah, the reason to care is that it's a sentimental reaction to something. It's the same reason why you would watch the news on any given day. Just because there's a murder or a kidnapping or a car accident or whatever doesn't mean that you are going to change your behavior, except that allows you to recognize that you need to reinforce your behavior. If you're already aware of your surroundings, a safe driver, or you take care of your kids well and you stay with them closely, you don't need to change your behavior based on the news. But you still need to be aware of the news, otherwise you'll change your behavior over time.
There's something good news in this, I think it's really good. I was actually concerned back in November. I researched this. Something like 85% of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, everything combined, all the exchanges in the United States right now, is being executed by robots.
No, they're not really robots. I mean, they're not machines that have motors in them that move around.
Well, not motors,
but they're computers.
They're computers. It's computerized trading, and basically much of it is based in momentum. Now, when I say 85%, it isn't just program trading. The indices are run by computers. In other words, if you're in an S&P 500 index fund, there is a computer that automatically, if you're in your 401k in an S&P 500 index fund and you get scared and you pull out of it, that order then goes in and the computers compile those orders. No human being is looking at this and making decisions, and sells out of that S&P 500 index fund at the end of the day. And there's nobody saying stocks are worth more, stocks are worth less. Nobody is looking at the value of the economy. They're just simply reacting to external stimuli,
right,
based on a computer algorithm. Now, the problem is the chasing the tail syndrome,
yeah,
of once the market starts down, if the momentum traders, used to be they were human beings who would make this decision, now computers are, start selling. And as they start selling, that causes the market go down, which causes more programs to start selling, which causes the market go down, which causes more programs to start selling. In essence, that's what happened in 1987. Yeah. But here's the good news. When the market went down to an absurd level, which it has done many times in my experience, real live human beings jumped in mass and started buying stocks and gave us the largest point rise in the Dow since it's been in existence. And that means that the rational human beings are still in control out there.
Right.
Unlike the mortgage market, which went completely berserk, irrational because of automated systems.
Yeah, it's all machines. Can I throw in another example?
Let me finish the sentence.
Yeah.
Back in 2008, the mortgage market went berserk because there were rules put into computers that says if this happens, you have to do this, and this was in contracts. You have to foreclose. You have to shut things down. And then that compounded the issue to where there were no buyers for mortgage securities except the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve, by the way, made a killing on this deal.
Oh, yeah.
So the prices went to zero, and that's in essence what happened in 1987. But it didn't happen this week. We had volume that made what happened in 1987 look like a pop gun. We had money changing hands this week that made the crash of 2008 look like a minor squall, and yet the market recovered with a gain for the end of the week. Yes, it's down for the year, and I need to go into that and finish the story here, but the disaster didn't occur that could have occurred this week because we have a system that still works, and that's probably the biggest lesson learned this week. Anyway, go ahead.
There's a couple of things to hit on this subject. Number one, Jack Bogle last week was in an interview and said that about 60% of all money that is in the S&P 500 index or stocks is in index funds. And he said that's dangerous. This is the inventor of the index fund, who's saying it's dangerous to have that much money going into index funds because you lose the active management role, mm-hmm, of defining what company's making a profit and what company isn't. He said that he had always intended it to ride on the backs of other people that are looking at companies and, yeah, saying, these are profitable companies, I'm going to buy them. These are not profitable companies, I'm not going to keep them. I'm either going to sell them or not buy them. And when the index fund comes in and they're just buying stocks according to what's kind of by size included in an index, that's dangerous. So that's another case of the tail wagging the dog. When the sell-off happened in the market, it was across the board, which means that people were selling out of index positions. If you have an across-the-board fall, it isn't because people with lots of individual stocks are selling all of their stocks at the same time. It's because somebody that has an index position, which internally owns lots of stocks all at the same time, is selling. And when enough of that happens, you see the opposite of what you want, which means that the good companies are knocked down as well. Well, the opposite of what you want if you already own it. If you don't already own it and you get the ability to jump in and buy it at that point, my thought on this is that long-term reason comes back in. If you have a long period of stability, index funds look great. Soon as you start hitting a lot of volatility, have you seen any volatility lately?
I don't know what it looks like.
It becomes less efficient to be in an index position because you're being thrown around regardless of the quality of your holdings underneath it, based on the whims of a lot of other people that really don't know what they're holding either. They own these funds that are kind of indexy, and they're not sure what that means. I mean, if you sell, what does that do? And what it does is it sells all the positions. Usually there's a little cash position, even in index funds, where they can just give you your money out of the cash position. But if enough people sell, they have to sell in the same ratio as they own.
And many of the S&P 500 index funds are now ETFs.
Yeah.
And ETFs don't hold cash positions, they just sell.
Right. And that's another danger in that some ETFs can be worth less. If a lot of people are selling an ETF, they sell in the middle of the day, and they can be less what they're worth inside. The ETF may own the whole 500 stocks of the S&P 500, but if it's being sold a lot during the day and there's not a lot of people buying that ETF, the underlying investments in the ETF become sometimes worth more than the stock price on the ETF.
I think a lot of people don't understand that about ETFs, that they do not necessarily track the index they supposedly are tracking.
Right. In a perfect situation, they do. Well, but when a lot of volatility, they don't. They get further and further away from the reality.
And some of them get way off and stay there for an extended period of time and suddenly crash. And matter of fact, there were one of the things, admittedly, they are relatively esoteric ETFs and they're ETNs, which people can't tell the difference between.
Exchange Traded Network?
Note.
Exchange traded nincompoop?
That's probably pretty close. Yeah. In some cases, they have gone completely out of business and people said, I want my money. And they say, well, you know,
there's no money in
there's
here.
There's no money left in here because we really screwed this one up. Which is why we tend to stick to mutual funds. Now, we don't exclusively because there's some cases where...
And when we say mutual funds, it's just like the blanket term for open-ended 1940 Act companies.
Yeah, and that's I know that's a little complex, but they're kind of proven over the long term, and they do close out the books every day and balance everything out, and they only trade once a day.
They're traded with the value of what they own rather than the demand for the fund.
So the net asset value of a mutual fund at the end of the day is exactly what the value of the underlying stocks or bonds is, and there's no wiggle room, whereas an ETF is a separate entity and can wander around all over the place. But I need to get back to
that. I wanted to wrap that piece up is that a lot of what we saw in the market, if you put in algorithmic trading, well, what does that have to do with what you own?
Al Gore.
Al Gore is involved somewhere. Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Sure.
He's a Democrat. What's he doing in here? Go back to making movies.
Yeah.
That's the common refrain. There's an algorithm involved if you sell from your index fund. The algorithm is a pro rata sale of the stocks based on the number of people selling the index fund on a given day. It's a simple algorithm, but if you're selling from an index fund or someone else is, there's an algorithm that says how much of each stock inside there gets sold. In an actively traded fund, that's not the case. So it's not just the really, really esoteric people, the sophisticated investors that have algorithms involved in their trades. If you've got a 401k and you've got the S&P 500 index in it, when you sell, you've got an algorithm involved.
And we have a caller on 773-1400, so you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, good explanation. I got a follow-up question. I may be wrong on this, but when there's a massive sell-off, there's a thing called the circuit breaker gets turned on. Can you explain that and how that works? Thanks.
Sure. That's a fantastic question. Another one.
Fundamentally, if the market goes into free fall and there are not buyers, but there's only sellers, there are algorithms, again, in the New York Stock Exchange, that temporarily shut down trading in the individual stock that's going on in.
And if it's big enough, in the entire exchange. So there's different levels of circuit breakers.
They've been turned on several occasions, and every time that there is a flash crash, which is a series of unintended events,
algorithmic coincidence,
they set a new rule to prevent that from happening again, which is, again, a very good thing. By the way, no circuit breakers were triggered this week. It was an orderly sell and an orderly purchase process. It was just more and higher volume. Well, and it really wasn't that high a volume. This was an interesting thing. One of the key things that happened is that there's a lot of traders on vacation.
Yeah, this is still the end of the year. This was Christmas week, and New Year's coming up next week.
So there's a lot of people who would have jumped in to buy in a down market who weren't present to do the purchasing, and since the computer algorithms don't require anybody to be there, they will jump in and sell, and there's nobody to buy, so they kept selling. And ultimately, I think some people came back from vacation or phoned in to their trading desk and said,
"Just buy something. This is great prices."
The price of the S&P 500 got down at the point when it was down almost in bear market territory, to where, by any measure I know of, the basket of stocks that composed the S&P 500 were a bargain, with a worst-case scenario going into 2019.
And I can say this without violating privacy. I had a series of clients that have been doing this long enough now, that have been watching the market long enough and doing it from a introspective and evidence-based approach, that brought in a lot of money this week. They saw the market was down, and they said, forget this, and last week for that matter. And sometimes it takes a day and a half to get into the market, because if you're buying mutual funds, you buy at the end of the day. So this is an important thing, is that I know people who recognize this as, this is a bargain opportunity, I'm bringing the money in. And if I knew those people, I probably was not alone across the market, which is why we had that 1,000-point gain, is that the money finally hit when people said, whoa, it's getting down way below where my thought of a good buying opportunity is. I'm going to get a bargain. And so they brought their money in, and they got bargains.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty cool.
It was, and I think that, by the way, is a strong signal that we're still in a bull market.
Yeah.
This is what's called a bull market correction. It literally stopped 0.7% from becoming a bear market by some definitions, and roared back like gangbusters. This is the kind of correction that occurs in a healthy bull market, and that's exactly what we're seeing. It isn't the end of the world.
Yeah,
and there is no speculative excess anywhere in the market that I can see.
I agree with that. And you had a story to wrap up about the tail wagging the dog. And I have another example of that when you're done. You were going down a path of algorithmic trading, moving things around.
Well,
and
this really is the bottom line to it, is there's an ongoing fear, and has been a fear ever since there's been computerized trading. And actually, even before computerized trading, back in 1987, it actually was computerized trading. It was an algorithm, but it was a really rough one that
very,
basically
very
said,
limit
if the
orders.
Market goes down this far, automatically sell, and they would put that in the program. It was a very crude program, but it was in there, and they called it portfolio insurance, and the market shot up quite a lot, and there were a lot of people with leverage in the market where they had margins, and they were borrowing money based on the fact that they couldn't lose money because they had an automatic sell order in. The problem was,
nobody had automatic buy orders for those sell orders.
When the market did go down a little bit and it started triggering sell orders, it literally overwhelmed the system. And so
it
even
weren't
though
enough
there were
people to buy for all those sells.
Actually, there were people trying to buy, but they couldn't get an order in because the lag in the system, the sell orders had, which were automated.
Yeah, they took up the whole traffic. Yeah.
The manual buy orders, because we were still in a manual system where you called your broker and said, buy this many shares.
Right, right.
And the buy orders were sitting there, but the sell orders completely overwhelmed them. And then once people realized that I want to buy this stock, let's say at $20 a share, and it's already fallen to $15,
well, you
then
can't
they
buy
would
it at
pull the buy order out again.
And so it's not sitting there anymore.
And finally, it fell a bunch, 20%. In a single day.
In a day. And that's still by far the biggest drop.
But then it recovered. And why did it recover fairly quickly? Well, it recovered fairly quickly, about 18 months. It took 18 months because people were just scared. I mean, the books started coming out, all the end of civilization, we know it was forecast, and the books were published. The bestsellers were all about that this is the new Great Depression. It was going to be caused by Ronald Reagan. And it didn't obviously work out that way. But the bottom line to it is, why did it recover fairly quickly? Because there were no excesses in the economy. There were no bubbles.
There were no problems that this was trying to solve.
And other than the fact that a Republican was president.
Right. And sometimes that happens.
But
sometimes people try to solve their political issues by selling in the market. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good idea.
But this case, again, if we look around the economy, there's a lot of signals out there. By the way, let me back up. I was going to finish the story of the stock market.
And I have something to add to it.
The market is down about 7% for the year, and it is actually down about 10% from where it was when the final phase of this economic experiment that I've been talking about for some time was put in place. There were two elements to this economics experiment. One was a massive tax cut that went into effect just under a year ago. And the second one was putting tariffs on imports from China and literally
and
from
everywhere
else. So a trade war and a tax cut. And these were experiments that were at least backed by and the Republicans in Congress. And this isn't political. That's just who did it. And the president. And we said at the time, this is an interesting economic experiment because the consensus in economic science is that both of those are really bad idea at this point, and they will probably hurt the economy. And I got a lot of pushback on that about how wonderful it was to get a tax cut, and we're going to get a stimulus. And
please believe me, we both benefited from it.
And
the long-term effect on the economy is not good.
One guy who is very well-educated and who expresses his opinion to me on a regular basis said he anticipated a 4% GDP this year and a 4% GDP next year because of the tax cuts and the tariffs. Well,
that's a problem.
The verdict is sort of in. We got one more trading day. The market is down from the time the experiment started, instead of continuing upward, which, by the way, it could have.
Yeah, the earnings are still good.
The earnings are up 20% short term, but the market is looking down the road and saying this is a potential disaster and is down roughly 10% from when the tariffs were enacted. And that really boils down to the simplest understanding is that there's a lot of things going on. Interest rates are getting the blame for it, but believe me, anybody that has anything to do with economics or the markets knew the Federal Reserve was going to raise.
This is not a surprise.
A quarter point.
The market knew it
and was planning to raise two more times next year. No surprises there. Certainly not enough to cause a 15% drop in the market in the month of December. What is uncertain is the potential for 25% tariffs on everything from China. And now a new uncertainty thrown in.
Government's shut down.
Well, the government is shut down, which causes a moral and emotional reaction. But a very real threat to the economy is the tweets from the president. And we're not being political here. It's just this is just economic reality to shut down the Mexican border. There's a lot of trade. $500 billion a year in trade back and forth across the Mexican border, much of which is an American corporation exporting, importing to get something done. If you shut down trade, you shut down most of the major automobile manufacturers. You shut so much of the economy down that we would almost certainly be plunged immediately into a recession if you shut down the border.
And this may get a lot of people throwing rotten vegetables at me, but I'm going to say it anyway. Illegal immigration is a problem, but it's a problem on the scale of you stubbed your toe. The United States stubbed its toe. It's a little bit painful. Ow! You might even dance around on one foot. It's something that we have our attention on at the moment. We're attempting to amputate our leg so that we don't stub our toe anymore. That may be a bit extreme when you're talking about this. The cost of immigration, and you can look this up as far back as you want, if you want to. Most people don't want to. They would rather listen to sound bites about entitlement spending and welfare spending on immigration. If you look at the real numbers, this is where the rotten vegetables get thrown at me. Even though I just said I don't believe that illegal immigration is good, illegal immigrants are net profitable to the U.S. government and extremely net profitable to the U.S. economy.
Yes.
I don't like the way it's happening, but you just look at the numbers. You see it, and that includes the stuff that's going out in welfare, in Medicaid, in health care, and all the things that happen when they are scamming the system, in essence, using false ID or whatever to get there. Their net benefit is they work hard. Now, we've got a problem in our laws that needs to be fixed to recognize parts of this, because there are bad guys coming across with them, not to the scale that the fear mongers are saying, but they're there. They're breaking laws to begin with, and if you just begin with breaking a law when you enter a country, it makes breaking other laws a little bit easier.
Well, wait a minute now. Statistically, and a lot of examinations have been done like this, the felony rate among native-born Americans
is much higher
than it is among illegal immigrants.
That's true. That is true.
Like 100 times higher. It's off the scale because somebody who's an illegal immigrant knows – that as soon as I commit any kind of a crime and I get arrested, I'm out of here.
Right. Well, here it gets actually – there's another statistic, and that is that illegal immigrants are 3 times more likely to commit a felony than legal immigrants.
Yeah, but –
they're 100 times less likely to commit a crime than natural-born citizens.
Right. Yeah.
So they are more dangerous than legal immigrants, but they're not as dangerous as the guy that was born across the street.
Yeah.
And that's just statistics. And I'm not trying to say illegal immigration is good. In fact, I'm saying the opposite of that. What I am saying is that if we're shutting down the government and shutting down trade with half of our big trade partners over the wall, well, the wall may be important. More important would be let's recognize what we should be having coming in, what we shouldn't be having coming in, and codify it. We keep postponing that, kicking the can down the road to say we'll figure that part out after we stop the illegal immigration. But we keep paying the illegal immigrants.
Let me make something clear and anticipate an objection here. We do not favor an open border with people pouring across the border.
Nope.
That would be disastrous, and it's been disastrous in other places at other times. What we're saying is the problem that exists today, as far as illegal immigration, economically, is such a mild problem, it's almost not a problem at all. Now, I will say Jake is absolutely right. What we have is a legal system and a set of laws that is so irrational that it forces illegal immigration in some cases. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill several years ago. The House rejected it. The House had enough votes to pass it, and the Speaker refused to bring it up for a vote, where we could have reformed the immigration system and largely stopped illegal immigration, because what we would have said is basically if there's jobs in the United States and employers can say, I can't find people to do manual labor, I can't find people to do the low-end work, all they do is submit and then they get – and this is compiled then by the Commerce Department, and the Commerce Department says we should give work permits to this number of people. And we should give – whether or not they have skills, basically let's do a background check on them, make sure they're not criminals. And then they get, in essence, a green card, and they get to come into the United States and do hard work that we can't find anybody else to do. It was rejected. It was a political move, and that happened, and that's all there is to it. And it is a good solution. And I will also say, I'm venturing an opinion here, to complete the wall across Texas – by the way, most of the border other than Texas has already got a wall of some kind.
Yeah.
But to complete the wall across Texas means seizing a great deal of private property.
Seizing or restricting access to.
Right. Because the river winds around all over the place, and the wall route that has been planned out goes straight, so there's big chunks of private property that would be left on the other side of the wall, which the government would not pay for. Basically, And if let's just say that there was a bill passed, by the way, it's a $25 billion minimum estimate with lots of overruns likely, not $5 billion. The down payment on it is just a down payment on it, as the president said. And if that were to occur, the odds of that wall actually getting constructed are nearly zero for a very simple reason. The lawsuits are already written up and ready to be filed against an illegal taking. In other words, if you own a, as one example that I thought was a good one, if you own a golf course and you're making money off your golf course and it occupies a loop, the land in the United States in a loop in the Rio Grande, and you put a wall across that blocks off access to three quarters of your golf course, the federal government has not said they're going to pay this guy for the three quarters of his golf course that he owns and he makes money off of. It says it's just going to pay for the strip of land the wall is on, because the rest of the land it didn't take, it's still his. He just won't be able to get to it ever again.
Well, there's a constitutional issue called eminent domain, which means that the government's supposed to recompense or pay back the landowner when they take it. Imagine somebody saying, I'm going to put a road through your house, but I'm only going to pay the value of the dirt.
Right. And the issue here is that if those lawsuits were successful, and every lawyer that has written on them has said they would be, certainly, because there's plenty of precedent, the price of the wall doubles to $50 billion. Now, $50 billion, you're talking about some serious money here.
Unless you make these some kind of gates for each of the property owners to get through, which gets really, really expensive, because some of those strips of property are pretty small. Some of them are bigger.
You have to have Border Patrol agents, and that would be an entry point into the United States. And there's no money. The cost, they've looked at the cost of putting gates in essence,
right,
so people can have free access to their land. And properly guarding the gates to make sure people don't come through the wall at the gates, and it's more expensive than buying the land from them.
Yeah.
And the point is that we're not talking about $5 billion. We're not talking about $25 billion. We're talking about a minimum. And when I say minimum, this is a government project and probably will
go over it by far.
Double it or triple it, of $50 billion. And very frankly, $50 billion, now you're talking about some real money. You're talking about something that would break the bank again. And this is, let me do something really weird. The debt ceiling is the next big crisis that the market, the people, the major traders in the market are deeply concerned about, the debt ceiling coming up in March. Because, and this is interesting to me, the Republican conservative, used to be called the Conservative Caucus, now it's called what, the Freedom Caucus?
Yeah, Freedom Caucus.
Has simply said that they will block, they were willing
Different
to shut
caucus.
The government down in March, and want, and they have the votes to do so, if the Democrats, because the Republicans won't have enough to do it.
Right.
And the Democrats won't have enough to do it. They're going to shut the government down over the debt ceiling in March.
Even though it was a Republican bill that asked for more spending, that required more spending, we're hitting deficits that are higher than the estimates of anybody. Even the worst estimates weren't this bad. So we're spending a lot of money and going into a lot of debt based on a spending bill that was passed by Republicans who are now threatening to not pay for it.
And I want to emphasize, this is not a political discussion.
No, there's a lot of politics in it, but this is we're talking about things that cause shakiness in the economy.
This is why the people who are dealing with trading in the market, a lot of people are bailing out simply because they're afraid of something that might happen. Now, let me say clearly here, it's very important to get this. We're almost out of time.
Well, we got commercials to play.
And we got a telephone call coming in.
Oh, there's a lot of stuff to do.
Let's get the telephone call, and I'll tell the important things.
Telephone caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Rick Insalato.
Hi, Rick.
Hey, talk about the Corps of Engineers building all this wall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Carlos Slim would build it.
Yeah, we don't have enough concrete. We could go to steel slats, but we don't have enough steel. We've got tariffs on steel because we don't have enough, remember?
Basically, if Congress funds the wall, then the promise won't be we'll build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. It's we'll build a wall and we'll pay a Mexican for it.
Yeah. Carlos Slim is the biggest concrete company that has concrete. There isn't enough concrete in the United States to do the wall.
Not in the United States, but in the area where they're going to build the wall.
Right, in the area. So.
And he's Mexican.
Yeah, talking about – say your question one more time. Let's put it in context.
The Army Corps of Engineers has been building all kinds of stuff in the United States.
They don't build
forever.
It. They don't build it. They contract with private
contractors. Yeah. They did in the 1960s. All the big projects that you see out there, the Stillhouse Lake, Belton Lake.
Well, they did.
They had the engine. Hold on. They had the engineers that designed the structure, and then they contracted with a private firm to build the structure. And it's the same as they do with roads or anywhere else. Now the Corps of Engineers monitors it. But they're not actually doing the building. In wartime, the Corps of Engineer does a lot of the building as well. But that's because in wartime, we draft a lot of people that would be private contractors.
So, basically that you'll have Mexican workers and Mexican concrete and Mexican steel and Mexican everything else to build the wall. If we build it, we'll pay Mexico to build the wall.
And as I see it, that's a break of a promise that Mexico's the one that's supposed to be paying for this. And this is the big issue. If he could find some way to get Mexico to pay for the wall in a legal way that didn't hurt anybody, I'd be for it. It makes sense. Let's do a wall, but it doesn't make sense with the price tag that's been labeled on it. If you get started on a project, you want to finish the project, or it's a road to nowhere. If you finish the project, we've just spent a huge amount of money. I mean, you think of the big dig in Boston and how everybody was so upset because of the overspending. Right. We have a potential of something, an order of magnitude larger than that.
And the other side of this wall, and you need to think about this, the biggest problem where the wall already exists is people tunneling under it. So that's one of the reasons the Border Patrol has had to beef itself up tremendously is checking for tunnels under the wall. Because no matter how high you
build it then.
Say that again?
Israel built a relatively...
Israel built it then. They've been successful.
They've got tremendous patrols up and down that.
They have a much smaller border, too.
And they also have lots of trouble with people burrowing under the wall. Last
week, they collapsed 5 tunnels.
The wall is only a tiny piece of the cost. The cost of patrolling the wall and guarding it, because any barrier that you put up has to be guarded, and tunneling under it is very difficult to detect, particularly in urban areas. Anyway, we got to do
commercials. There's a root cause. There is a solution here to illegal immigrants. You go to the root cause, and we don't, unfortunately, have time to talk about that because we got to play some commercials, and then in the hour, we'll be back next hour, though. We might have a very short time back between now and the end of the break. So we'll see you on the other side. Here we go.
Still playing, and we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We just have a couple of minutes between now and the end of the hour. We did have a call coming in on 773-1400. Let me say that we favor border security, and we favor stopping illegal immigration. Let that be very, very clear. The issue is how to go about doing it and not to destroy the economy in the process. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, hi, Jeff, Jake. Listen, I've got two things. One is, in the next 20 years, how much do you think it would actually cost us if we didn't have the wall because of illegal immigration?
Because it would just be...
It's expensive.
It'd be staggering. It would be.
We're not repairing our bridges right now.
It would be a staggering cost because I was in the Army a long time as an officer, and I understand how to build barriers. And the fact is that barriers throughout history have not worked, unless you're willing to put a large force of people guarding that barrier, because a static barrier is easy to bypass. Probably the most recent one that people are aware of is the Maginot Line
that the French
built very, very carefully and spent a huge chunk of their economy on, and the Germans went around the end of it. And that's the point with a barrier. You have to have
the Great Wall of China.
The Great Wall of China didn't work. The Mongols, by the way, the ruling family, the emperors after the wall was built, were the Mongols who the wall was meant to keep out. The wall across Berlin did not work. No, walls keeping people in or out don't work. The Israelis do have walls up, but they also have, compared
active,
to the size...
Active patrols.
The size of their economy, the number of people they have military patrolling those walls is out of sight, and they still have to work really, really hard because people come under the wall. The other thing is, the issue is, in Europe, they have a natural sea barrier between them and the rest of the world. It has not stopped mass immigration because there are things called boats. And all that happens if we spend $25 billion plus another $25 billion,
just change the way they come in. And here's the other.
Just go around the end of it.
Here's the biggest issue. Let me throw this in, and then I want to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
The majority of illegal immigrants, and by majority, I mean it approaches 80%, come in by overstaying visas. Okay, you know. Now you say your last thing because we're almost out of time.
Yeah. My other last thing is, why can't we just have a law that is directed to the employers and, like, have a three strikes or out law where the first time we catch you with illegal working on your place, then it's a big fine.
I agree with you. I think that's a fantastic idea.
It's a huge fine and some kind of way where the FCC, you can't advertise your business
Here's the problem.
And then the third time is something like your company is seized and it's auctioned off to the public.
Many of those are working in your yard cutting the lawn.
Yeah, it would be you maybe or me.
That's fine too.
Okay. But that won't ever pass.
You're on the right track, and we're about out of time. Thank you for the call.
Good call and good idea. We'll talk about that some more next hour. That is one of the solutions.
And we got to wrap up. If you'd like to call us off the air locally, it's 947-1111. If you want it toll-free, 1-800-914-PLAN. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.